This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLINGsoap.com.
Stretched by Torres, the set, the kick, and the fish. It's deep to left field. This one may be off the wall, maybe in the screen.
Lang and Chernyshev on top as expected. They're eligible for Salt Lake City.
All right. Welcome to Indian All-Stars. Bill Black here with my guest today, author Ed Rice, the author of Baseball's First Indian, about a biography of Louis Sokolexis, the first Native American to play Major League Baseball, and his follow-up book is Louis Sokolexis' cousin, Native Trailblazer. Whoops, let me not block out. Alex Sokolexis, marathon runner. Welcome, Ed. I read the Louis Sokolexis book a little while back and was hoping to be able to talk to you at some point because I thought it was fabulous, well-written and well-researched and really, really well done. And then to find out that you wrote the one about
Andrew.
Alex, I thought it was
his awesome. Name is Andrew.
Andrew, I keep saying Alex. It's Andrew.
Yeah.
My daughter's name's Alex, and that's just what jumps into my head. So, sorry. Andrew Sokolexis. And anyway, here we are. I would love to know how you got on that track in the first place.
Oh, my goodness, Bill. It's a kind of a three-part answer. So I grew up close to where Lewis is buried, 13 miles away from the Penobscot Reserve,
okay,
on the Penobscot River, just 13 miles north of Bangor, Maine. And my dad was a huge baseball fan, and he made sure when I was a young boy that we went over onto the island and we visited Lewis's gravesite.
Uh-huh.
So we start off with a huge interest in baseball and a huge interest in indigenous peoples because I grew up so close to the island.
Sure.
The third element that really kicks in big time is when I go off to college, Northeastern University in downtown Boston, and I become a journalist. And the journalism passion leads me to the idea that someday I'd like to write a worthwhile book, a book that will be meaningful to people. And it turns out that when I rediscover Lewis after so many years, I'm stunned by the idea that no one's ever done a book on him.
Sure.
And he seems to me to be just too fascinating a figure for that to be true. The unfortunate part about all of this is that he has died so many years before that there's nobody around for me to interview. This is going to have to be a library researched book. And it took me nearly a quarter of a century to do it properly, at least to my own mind of what I would need to do. So you tie together the elements of interest in indigenous peoples, passion for baseball, and this idea of being a journalist and wanting to write a book of some value. And that's where the three elements all tie together. That's why Lewis.
Okay. I think that's fabulous. The fact that you have like a very personal connection and memory, not only just being from that geographical location, but I mean, heck, you went to his gravesite and stuff. And that's really, really cool.
thank you.
So, as I was going through and reading it, I was fascinated with the amount of detail that you were able to get going through basically game by game and day by day through his short career. But,
yep.
You know, a flash in the pan, but what's amazing feats that this young guy accomplished? And,
yes.
And the amount of information that you were able to get, just, I guess, digging through the library is amazing.
Thank you, Bill. Yeah, this is an important point to raise to people. I developed a passion for interviewing people, getting information, speaking to the other side of whatever issue happened to be there so that I could then present to a reader everything available to make his or her own judgment based on the information presented. Now I'm presented with the challenge of a lifetime. There's nobody alive to talk to. This is all going to have to come from research. And the problem, Bill, is that the 1890s are notorious for one of the worst eras in journalism in American print history. You can't trust a lot of the newspaper accounts that are there. That means that I'm going to have to try to find as many accounts, for instance, of one game, if it's possible to do that, in order to appreciate the fact. And the fact that Lewis was bigger than life in his own time means that some of the stuff may well not, you know, square out with the truth. I mean, there are stories about things that Lewis did on the baseball field that are next to impossible. And I think, you know, in the book, I point out some of them. You don't sure. swim across a river, jump up on the other side and catch a potential home run ball. So you've got a number of different things that we have to understand. He's legendary in his own time. And at some time, Bill, if you've got a point or a time for me to do this, I really should point out to people that professional baseball is nowhere near as possible popular back then as it is today. And people don't recognize that a lot of what Lewis did on the town ball fields in summer of Maine, and then in college baseball, which was then hugely popular, you can honestly say that he had a complete baseball career without needing the short amount of time playing in the major leagues.
Right. It wasn't nearly the prestigious level getting to the majors as it is now.
Yeah. Right. In fact, a lot of people, when I have a paragraph in the book that talks about the great college baseball players of the late 19th century, and you and I and baseball fans aren't going to recognize a single one of those names. And
right.
I think the answer lies in the idea that there's no money in professional baseball. And if they played college baseball, that education they got is probably turning them into lawyers and doctors and engineers, mm-hmm. and they're going to make the kind of money that, you know, they can raise families and live comfortably. And what they're probably going to do in that era, especially if they live in the great Northeast where baseball was huge in that era, is play town ball baseball games. And sure. they may very, very well look forward to the time when they play their arch rival town across the river, Bangor Brewer, I'm thinking of, and just play those few baseball games and then go back to their regular lives.
Right.
And so it's an era where, if you remember in the book, Lewis actually winds up back on the town ball fields of Maine, you know, as late as 1907. Mm-hmm. And he's 35 years old then, playing for the Bangor team in a semi-pro league. And he actually plays two games against the Negro League barnstorming team that came through Bangor. And so I have a lot of fun letting people see him going up against Pop Lloyd, who is one of the great players of Negro Leagues.
Yeah, I saw your Facebook little bio posts about Pop Lloyd. That's fascinating. Another guy sounds like a legendary figure that I've never heard of, and I'm pretty big baseball fan too. But so again, kudos for bringing these things back up. That's kind of why I have this whole Indian All-Stars thing, is to try and help people from today's generation learn the stories about guys like Louis Sokolexis and, you know, that kind of thing, that have been forgotten, that were phenomenal role model, hold him up as like Superman, right?
Exactly. I mean,
he had other issues in his life that were not so great. Everybody has their things. But
right.
To accomplish what he did and be that major of a star and still be a pretty humble, down-to-earth guy, it sounds like, I think that's all admirable stuff. And people need to know that there was an Indian playing baseball before Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. That's right?
Exactly. I think one of the issues that you're hitting on here is – what is it? Why am I having to fight the fight I am fighting with the Baseball Hall of Fame, with Major League Baseball itself? Why don't we have a celebration of these pioneer players? And Bill, this is where Ed Rice gets himself in trouble. It was one thing to go out and do that book and get it into libraries. It's another thing, as a white guy from Bangor, Maine, just fascinated with the story, to then have to get into the idea of blood quantum and who right. is an Indian and who isn't. And I'm sure yep. you're familiar with the James Madison toy fiasco.
Right.
So for
right.
a long while, we were going to supplant Sokolexis and we were going to make an Irishman the first Sioux Indian baseball player. And the story made my head hurt. In my first edition of the book that came out in 2003, I was only able to raise the big question. When the book was reissued in 2019, and I hope that's the copy that you were able to get your hands on, if you've got that copy.
I don't think so. I think I have the initial one, so I'll have to pick up the new one.
New one, there was a writer down in Pittsburgh who went and investigated James Madison Toy and his descendants and spoke to people, and he was able to debunk a myth. And so wow. what I have done is been able to take one person off this list that shouldn't be there. And I've looked at some of the other players, Zach Wheat, for instance. Everybody can read the bio, see that he has a Cherokee mother. Yep. The problem is that Zach Wheat, one, he was never registered in the U.S. Census as living on an Indian reserve at any point. Two, he was never registered with a tribe. And that's very significant, because the ones who are our pioneer American Indian players, they are. They're registered with the tribe. And number three, they're proud of it. They're sure. proud of their American Indian heritage. And quite frankly, Zach Wheat didn't want to talk about it. He was able to forgive me, pass for white.
Sure.
And in that era, it would have been healthier for him. He would have done better.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah.
He's going to do better.
It wasn't cool to be Indian at that point. Yeah.
No, it wasn't. In fact, there were horrible, vestiges of racism. It was virulent right through American society. Yeah. This is not an era, the late 19th century or the early 20th century. So a lot of these guys don't want to be recognized. The guy that you've got the picture on the wall there is one of the great pitchers of all time. He nearly had a nervous breakdown over the treatment that he received. There are horrible rumors about Charlie Bender trying to throw World Series games that nobody can prove, but one biographer wanted to suggest it. And it right. all comes down to the idea of being called chief and being mistreated, because chief wasn't meant respectfully in his
era. No, it wasn't. It was not a respectful term. Yeah.
Exactly. So when we look at how I identify Lewis Sock Alexis now, I identify him as the first known American Indian, first known Native American, depending on which of those terminology. I can get myself whacked upside my head by the people who want me to call him an American Indian and by the people who want to call him a Native American.
Right.
But we're going to say he's the first known one to play, that all of his peers, the people playing against him, the crowd members, the media writing about him, they know. The other players, I can easily raise the question to you, we don't know if they knew.
Sure.
And it's a significant point for me because Charlie Bender deserves better, John Myers deserves better, mm-hmm. Jim Thorpe, for the time that he played, deserves better. And Lewis absolutely does, because the period, as you saw going through game by game of his, the mistreatments, which are right across the board, you know, yeah. It was a horrible time, and the treatment he received. And so I've been able to come down with the idea of first known one, and then I don't think there's really the questions that are raised at me about that.
Sure. I think that's a great solution to that dilemma,
and yes,
and it is certainly justifiable. So
thank you.
So when you're doing all the research, what's one feat or one specific incident that happened during Lewis Sock Alexis's baseball career that stood out to you? That, I mean, because there are lots of stories and stuff, and like you said, some of them are hyperbole, some of them are exaggerated, but they're all based on some really pretty amazing feats of athleticism, and I'd just like to see if something really jumps out at you.
It does, and I end my talks almost always with the one anecdote that I want people to take away about his greatness as a player. And I really owe, I'm sure you're familiar with the Sabre Group, the Society for American Baseball Research.
Right.
And I was fortunate to have a college friend of mine who was one of those people and lives in downtown Boston. And he was able to research games I couldn't find the newspapers for. Lewis, after the issues that he had playing Major League Baseball, which involved alcoholism and the issues that he had with it, had dropped down to something called the New England League, and he was in Hartford in 1899. And he didn't last long there because the issues cropped up again. Yeah. So he dropped even lower. He dropped to something called the Connecticut League, and these were some isolated towns that had a league just below the New England League for okay. players to play. Uh-huh. And the first place that Lewis wound up was a place called Bristol, Connecticut. And I've tried to get the ESPN people to pay some attention to this because I think one of the great moments in civil rights baseball history happened right on a baseball field in Bristol. He had a terrible time in Bristol, and unfortunately the drinking got him released. But then there was a town also in the Connecticut League, Waterbury, Connecticut. And the player that was there was a former major league player, and he brought Lewis in and he had him play for his Waterbury team. And all of a sudden he did well. And Lewis was fine. And then the moment came that I closed my talks with. The team is in Bristol to play the Bristol okay. team. And it's not going well for the Waterbury team. They're down by 3 runs. And it's late in the game, and the bases are loaded. There are 2 out, and you know what's coming next. Sure. Lewis Sock Alexis is the batter. But before he can get in the batter's box, the Bristol fans are brutal. And you can just imagine the worst of whatever Jackie Robinson listened to. That's what Lewis is listening to. And he's got a history in that town of being exactly the stereotype that they want to hear. Lewis can't even get into the batter's box. The fans are so noisy. And the journalism here is absolutely spectacular because the writer is writing exactly what's going on. And he describes a kid with, he calls him yaller hair. I took it to be yellow hair, who after a certain point of this hubbub, just says very derogatorily, "How'd you like to be the Indian?" And everybody guffaws and, "Oh yeah, this is absolutely brutal. You know, just what's going on here." Everybody laughs. So finally they finally shut up. Lewis steps into the batter's box and yes, he hits the next pitch right over the center fielder's head on a line. It's just described. All three guys that are on base score. Lewis is not the runner that he had been. He winds up on second base, and he's standing out there. And then suddenly, as this writer describes it, the crowd is just silent. And they just, all of a sudden, they're so, they can't believe what they just saw in the face of what they'd done. Right. And now the kid with yellow hair yells out once again, only this time he means it respectfully, "How'd you like to be the Indian?" And everybody applauds. And it's my favorite moment because there he is right in the face, you know, in the lion's den. And so Roger Conner, and I don't know if baseball fans will remember this, but Roger Conner is Babe Ruth before Babe Ruth came along. He was the guy who had the home run record. It wasn't much because he didn't hit that many of them. He played for the old New York Giants. And when he retired from professional baseball, he moved back home to Waterbury, Connecticut. He, his wife, and his brother started this semi-pro baseball team. And it was Roger Conner who took Lewis into Waterbury and gave him that third chance that season. And then we are rewarded with this incredible story of just what a spectacular baseball player Lewis is in the face of the worst kinds of racism you could imagine. So that's one of my favorites. Of course, I could go on for an hour here, Bill. So
well, I'd love to hear them all, but no, I love that story and the fact that he was able to turn the tide so dramatically.
Exactly.
And that it was documented.
That's
fabulous.
Yeah, I'm just sorry that the ESPN people aren't interested in this. I tried several times to find somebody there to appreciate what happened on a baseball field right in Bristol, Connecticut, and nobody ever got back to
me. Right in their backyard. Wow.
Right there. Incredible story. Are we going to talk about Andrew at all? I really would like to get in a
play. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Let's transition. It's the Olympics time right now, and running is kind of on everybody's mind.
Absolutely.
Let's jump into that. I'll be honest. I just started reading this one the other day, so
okay.
It's still an unknown story to me for the most part.
Right. And I think that's important, Bill, for you, because I went down and I looked at the list of wonderful indigenous athletes that you've been able to acknowledge and go sport by sport by sport. And so we're going to be able to add Andrew to that list, I hope, shortly, because what he did in a very short span of time was remarkable. He was a sickly boy. The Penobscots, and I don't know about the tribes out in the Pacific Northwest, but the tribes in the East use a lot of tobacco. Very, very, it's sacred, and it's an involvement that, you know, it sort of scares you. And apparently, Andrew, as a youth, was introduced to it, and he was very sickly, and that he actually didn't start running with his dad, who was actually known as a long-distance runner, back in the time when the Penobscots actually used to chase their prey down before there were actual weapons. They were prized members of the tribe who could run and outrun the animals that they wished to eat. And so Andrew, not until around 17 or 18 years old, does he surface as this remarkable runner. And at that point, he goes to the Boston Marathon in 1911 with no experience in long-distance races and finishes an incredible 17th. There were about 50 or 60 people there. So in 1912, he almost wins the Boston Marathon. He breaks what would have been the course record, except the man that beat him broke the record by even more, and he finished second. That gets him invited to the opportunity to participate and be selected for a 12-man U.S. Olympic marathon team. Up in that era, the idea was that the few countries that did participate, they could have up to 12 participants in the marathon because there just weren't that many countries doing it.
Wow.
So Andrew goes. And what is remarkable is that this is going to turn out to be the Olympiad with the most indigenous peoples from the U.S. participating on the team. You already know and have documented that Louis Tiwanima is going to win a silver medal in the 10,000-meter race.
Right.
And, of course, you can't talk about the 1912 Olympic Games without talking about the double that Jim Thorpe does with the pentathlon and the decathlon, and he wins them both. And so there are actually three Native Americans on that team, and Andrew is actually the American favorite to win that marathon, and it's the last event of the 1912 Olympic Games, as it had been going back to its origins and coming through as it is to this day, that they hold that last, holding that sort of sacred place. And so there were three of them there that were participating. Andrew has a very, very tough day, as the American team does. He finishes fourth, however. It's like in the 90s. The mid-90s, in a brutal day, a Portuguese runner actually dies of heat stroke. It's the only time that someone has actually died as a result of their participation in a marathon or a participation in an Olympic event, forgive me. And so Andrew has a remarkable fourth place finish. And then in 1913, he comes back at the Boston Marathon and he's again second. And so he really belongs on any list of participants who have done remarkable things.
Absolutely.
As an American Indian participating in major sports. And so I was able to get both of them nominated in 1999 into the American Indian Athletic Hall of Fame, which I didn't know existed up until reading about Billy Mills, who was probably the most famous American Indian to do anything in the Olympics other than Thorpe. And I wanted to make sure that both Sauk Alexis cousins were acknowledged for how fantastic they were. Andrew's life is very, very short. Tuberculosis. He contracts it in 1913. He battles it until his death in 1919. So I was able to piece together a biography of him and, you know, feel that he's equally deserving of attention.
Absolutely. Boy, to come in second and then to be just out of the medal contention, I mean, just out of, just missing it by that much, that's tough. That's tough.
You're calling it. That's why I think there was availability for me to write a book. If he finishes first in the Boston Marathon, somebody is going to have done this book. If he finishes in the medals, somebody is going to have done this book. But unfortunately, you know, he's kind of got that position that's considered damned in the Olympic Games, finishing fourth. That's just out of the medals.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, I should tell you the fun anecdote. So Ed Rice is known pretty well in his home state of Maine as a runner, as a long distance runner. And I put on a charity race in Maine for over 20 years. And so it was my running friends who, after the Lewis book came out, said, "Ed, you got the wrong Sauk Alexis." And I said, "I know what you're talking about. You want about the marathon runner. I did the book on the baseball player. You want to see the book about the marathon runner?" And I said, "I will undertake it and I'll do it." And what worked out in my best interest, but certainly not for Andrew, it didn't take anywhere near the amount of time because he's only on the big stage in 1911. And by at the end of 1913, he's never going to compete again. So the book is about, you know, that period and the races I could find that he did. Yeah. But it's a tragic story. He clearly had an incredible amount of talent.
Yeah. It's interesting talking about that 1912 Olympic team and reading stories about Jim Thorpe, and I read a little bit about Louis Tuonima, like on the boat going over, how they were trying to train and stuff, and he had to be right in the middle of that as well. Being a distance runner, what do? You're on a boat for a week.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing about the American team going over there was a huge controversy in that many of these runners, particularly marathon runners, had their own schedule, how they went about things. And now they're presented with a coach, and this coach demands that they all run together. Well, I coached high school cross country for 2 years. I never, ever did that to my young students. They ran in the groups that they were comfortable running with, each at their skill level. I was lucky to have a young lady who was particularly skilled. She was better than the other young ladies on the team. She ran with the boys. She ran at her level, her comfort level, and I helped to prepare them to give their best races. In 1920s, they were forced into a strategy, a competing strategy, and it allowed two South African runners to go out ahead of the entire field, finish first and second, and then the Americans had to scramble to try to make up the distance, and it was just insurmountable. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was very hot out there. Clearly, Andrew was put in a situation where he was compromised. He was not allowed to run his race. He had to run what the coach demanded he run.
Well, that's the way it is, I guess, but
boy, tough. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Let me ask you this. Is there any question that I didn't ask you about any of this? Either of these guys, or maybe both of them, that you think that I probably should have?
Okay. I think what I like seeing you do, and what I hope that you have a forum that will continue to do this, is that Charlie Bend is not getting all the credit he deserves. John Myers isn't getting all the credit he deserves. Thorpe wasn't even playing his best sport. I mean, by all accounts, you know, he's a much better football player, he's a much better track and field performer. You know, in the society that he lived in, he wasn't given the opportunity to coach. He's playing baseball because it's the only sport that will actually pay him a little bit of money. And right. What I've tried to do with, for instance, the Baseball Hall of Fame is you recognize in these wonderful exhibition halls the African-American players. You're not doing a good enough job, and I'm hoping what just happened, the recognition of all their records, is going to start to make the Josh Gibsons and the Satchel Pages and the Pop Lloyds and the Cool Papa Bells.
Cool Papa Bell, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The names they should be, they're not getting recognized because everybody is putting it all on Jackie Robinson. Right. That's wonderful, but we've done that. Now it's time to recognize these other guys. My job is to, for the way I see it now, I've got these books out there. The one on Lewis is saying this is the first known American Indian. He suffered greatly. He was responsible for that nickname. There's no question about that. It wasn't meant flatteringly back then, but right. He's the one that was there. And Cleveland still doesn't recognize him properly. I mean, Chief Wahoo, really?
Yeah, right.
And the nickname, that wasn't recognizing him. Now they don't have to pay any attention to him, which is pretty much what they're doing. And it upsets me. They've changed some of the language around the ballpark in deference to what Ed Rice has told them about what Lewis did. But we're still not getting the recognition from Cleveland or the Major League Baseball entity itself about these pioneer players. And the Baseball Hall of Fame still doesn't have a permanent exhibit to talk about what these guys did as the pioneer players. That is what drives me now, to keep talking wherever I can to get people to recognize. I can name for you four guys. You want to find a couple of other guys who deserve to be on that list, yes, and they were registered with the tribe and they were proud of their heritage, go ahead and add them. But that we shouldn't keep four guys out because we're not sure of who the first one was or who the right second or third ones were. I can connect the dots for you to Charlie Bender, to John Myers, and to Jim Thorpe. I can connect the dots in just one person in each instance and show you that Lewis is directly responsible for Charlie Bender, and he's directly responsible for Thorpe and Myers. Have you got time for this? Well, I can give it to you as background, and you can use it yourself, but Connie Mack, yes. Charlie Bender, because he saw Lewis play. He writes a whole paragraph on Lewis in his autobiography. John McGraw was the third baseman for the Baltimore Orioles in 1897. And when he saw what Sock Alexis could do, he went after John Myers and he went after Jim Thorpe. There it is. There's your connection. It's obvious. Oh, by the way, Charlie Bender pitched to a catcher named Mike Doc Powers. That was Sock Alexis's teammate at Holy Cross College. So, really? I mean, they're going to know about who Sock Alexis was, and they're going to think to themselves, there are other American Indians out there who can do this.
Yeah. That's
so
awesome.
Anyway, if you get other questions and you'd like to do this again, I'm happy to do it.
I would love to follow up a little bit more after I read the Andrew Sock Alexis, after I finish it. I'd love to get back with you and talk about that a little bit more in depth. I think this is fascinating. I love to hear your stories.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate that. If you can, check a local library or something. See if you can get the 2019. I was able to update a lot of my information on Lewis, including just dispelling the James Madison toy myth. I've got it completely wiped out right in that one. So if you can, a library can interlibrary loan it for you, I'm sure.
I'll look for it.
Thank you.
So, again, thanks a lot, Ed. I appreciate it. I'm going to post a link to both of your books, and
thank you.
And hopefully, we'll help spread the word a little bit more.
I love it. I love what you're doing, Bill. Congratulations. Keep it up.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate that a lot.
Great.
Okay. Take care. We'll talk to you later.
Talk to you down the line.
Okay. Take care. Bye bye.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history. But as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.